This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. Look for their newest line, Pristine, the only complete line of pet food made with responsibly sourced ingredients. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
We talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Those were the days we were young. We drove in circles, baby. The timing grows old. Pull on the trigger, my gun. It's feeling heavy, weighty. It's dark like your soul. Young and thriving.
Welcome to Snacky Tunes. I'm one half your host, Greg Brusnitz, sitting with you in Paris with the owners, partners, best friends, coffee addicts of Bello Coffee. Welcome to the show.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thomas and Jeff. So before we get into your backstories, let's talk about the history of coffee in Paris. Obviously introduced in 1644. And then terrible for 300 something years. Yeah. The phrase that I came across that I thought was really funny was sock juice or bad sock juice. Uh-huh. Could you maybe give a bit of history on that. And what is it in French? Because I would butcher it.
So, Socius in French is jus de chaussettes. So it's actually technically, it means what it is. It's like making your coffee with a pair of socius. And because French culture think like the espresso is your ultimate way of drinking coffee. And when people, French are very proud of their food culture and everything. So they're like thinking like soap juice can be only the coffee in diner you can have. And that's also the coffee that they used to have at home. And most of the time they used to have very good coffee at home. So that's why like they're getting close to the soap juice to like bad quality coffee.
And for a country that's really well known for its ingredients, why do you think that the proliferation of bad coffee or bad sock juice coffee happened?
I think people were drinking bad coffee, but they were convinced they were drinking good coffee. And that's what it is. So you've always had coffee because coffee's been around for a really long time. And anywhere you go where specialty coffee hasn't arrived yet, you come across cultures where people are absolutely convinced that their coffee, specifically the one that they're drinking at their cafe, is the best coffee on earth, and that every other coffee is just terrible.
I think the idea is also is like people think because you get many, many more places to have a good coffee in specialty coffee places in US or in Nordic places. But it's still, there's two signs. If you compare to like the commodity coffee is still bad in US. Commodity coffee is still bad in Australia. But good spot for good coffee, there's so many in all of this country. And I think France has, as Jeff say, like people used to think like, oh, we do good coffee everywhere, so why we should change anything? And I think in most of the places, like all over the world, they had bad coffee, but some places choose to change to good coffee.
Right, so everyone here just had a really bad frame of reference, and it was just, everyone was like, well, I mean, it just tastes like this everywhere, so this is the best version of a bad thing.
Yeah, I think also one of the main reasons also is like, because France and some country in south of Europe has a strong story with colonies, especially in Africa, and they used to import Robusta coffee from all of this country. And we know that Robusta is less aromatic and not as good as could be Arabica. So it's also like a heavy, heavy things in France like Robusta.
Right, so a lot of it was like, oh, we grew these crops from places we colonized, so it makes sense. It's like a very good supply chain, and why wouldn't we feed money back into there or not pay for it or whatever the resources would be, instead of being like, let's just go find the best.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, Thomas, let's start with you. So you're obviously from France. Where did you grow up?
I was born in south of France, but I grew up in west of France, in the Loire Valley. And my family is a farmer, so I grew up in produce, a lot of products like we used to make goat cheese, and after that I traveled a bit in England and in Australia, and I went back to France 8 years ago now in Paris.
And how did you get into the coffee game?
Because I had to get money at the beginning. And now at the beginning was like more, I was working in hospitality to pay my study at my university. And at a certain point, I had more pleasure at working behind a bar than studying. So I chose to do more bars. And when I went to Australia, I discovered coffee shops as one does. Yeah. And
home with the flat white.
Yeah.
I mean, depending who you ask.
Exactly. But at that point, when I were there, like that was 10 years ago, and the coffee wasn't as good as we think. Like, coffee shops were there, there were so many, but the coffee was like still bad, like if you compare to now. But the idea of a coffee shop, the idea of having a place and you don't serve alcohol, you bring so many people from different like population, like men, women, children, that was some kind of good idea and good vibes that I want to bring in France. And when I came back to France, I was like, oh, I'm going to open a coffee shop. So.
And what was the name of the... You opened two. What was the first one you opened?
So the first one was, from my part, was Tenbel, which is a coffee shop near the Canal Saint-Martin. And I opened it 5 years ago. I sold my chair last year, but yeah. And the second one is technically La Fontaine, which is not really a coffee shop, but really.
Sure. And for the beans that you were getting for Tenbel's, what was the current state of them? And obviously 5 years ago, where were you getting them from? Where were you sourcing them?
That's actually, Belleville is because of that. Like, the roastery become a roastery because of that. Because when I started Tenbel, I couldn't find the coffee that I want in France. So we were buying coffee from a friend in England, a roaster called Haspin.
Mm.
And until a certain point, then my business partner, David, was like, oh, we should start a roastery because it's stupid to buy coffee from somewhere else and it could be in France.
And he owned Telescope Coffee, right?
Yeah, at that point, yeah.
So it was just two very disgruntled coffee owners who knew that there was better stuff out there but couldn't get it.
Yeah, and I think even before we opened the shops, we had an association together called the Frog Fight. It used to be like an event when we used to bring coffee from all over the world and share it with people, and it worked very, very well. And I think we had we were thinking that French people would be very ready to that and very interesting on having like better produce.
Where were you sourcing the coffee from for the events, or how would you get the beans?
We used to just call friends all over the world and say, hey, I'm doing this event, can you send me some coffee from Chicago, from Australia, Norway, and people were very, very happy to just send us beans and from, I don't know, one farm, different process, or three farmers from the same region. Like, it was more an idea of sharing that things with people.
And did they come roasted, or did you roast them once you got them?
No, they came roasted.
Okay,
and,
so full.
Yeah,
full,
at that time.
At that time.
At that time, yeah.
And Jeff, American.
Well, actually, I'm actually French. That's
oh.
The thing. Yeah, it's I trick people. I was a spy for a very long time.
You just removed the entire accent.
Yeah.
Lived in the States for a long time.
No, I speak English like this as well, if you prefer.
No, because then no one will be able to tell you apart in the interview, so
yeah.
It's like very, very helpful.
No, I'm actually, so I was actually born in the U.S., which is kind of very, very funny, just because my dad was a huge fan of America and the U.S., and he wanted me to be American. So basically, I was just born in the U.S., and then my parents flew home, and I grew up in Paris. And but then after high school, I moved to the U.S., and I spent 11 years there, about 11. And then a couple years in London, and then I've been back in Paris for 9 years, I think. Yeah.
And originally you were in the music industry, entrepreneur.
I was, yeah. Well, actually I did a lot of different things. I was always an entrepreneur, and I played in rock bands.
Please name the bands.
No. These will forever remain nameless. they were not good. I did manage a few other bands, and while I was doing that, I wasn't earning money, but I was working as a web developer, and I always had tech jobs and working at tech startups. And then after spending all that time in the US, I wanted to move back to Europe, and so I did an MBA at INSEAD, just right outside of Paris. Which is a one-year MBA program, and when I finished that, I moved to London, and I continued working in tech, always with a connection to music. I was working at Last.fm, and then after that, I moved back to Paris, did my own startup, which went really well for 4 years, but then unfortunately went out of business. And that was at the same time that I met David and Thomas. Essentially, I was going on my way to work, stopping at Tenbel's, Thomas' coffee shop, every morning, because his coffee shop was literally down the street, like a 30-second walk from my house. And so I would get my coffee there every day, and we became friends. And when they decided to start up Belleville, I decided to join them. And there was it was actually a great. Initially, I was just an investor, after 2 years of running the business, I ended up joining the business full time, as we had like very complementary skills. I'm actually 10 years older than these guys, and so I had I'd gone through the growth phase of companies, and I knew how to develop businesses, and these guys knew everything that I didn't know about coffee and roasting and all these things, so it was a good match.
We're gonna take a quick musical break, and then we're gonna talk about the inception and conception of Belleville, and we'll be right back here on Snacky Tunes.
with the blood on my face after biting my neck. Sure, alright. It would have been a perfect crime, but thank you, baby. I'll do the time to see that look on your face, baby. If you wanna leave me, yeah, in my box through the changing of the clocks. Sure, alright. I'll eat some other time. For you, baby, I'd starve myself blind. Oh, yeah, blood and a smile on my face. Blood and a smile on my face. Your neck's like candy sugar. Blood and a smile on my face. Yeah, I'm flying rodent is a butterfly. Hierarchy goodbye. I wrote a formal resignation to my leader for a piece of your pie. I take the steak for you, but love for you, you make me high. Oh yeah, blood and a smile on my face. Blood and a smile on my face. You're like candy.
So, Tomas, when did you and David begin to have the idea of creating your own coffee company?
Very early, actually. Like, I think a few months after we met, we were thinking about doing something together about coffee. But at the beginning, we didn't really know if he was on, like, I don't know, on training, on events, on coffee business, like coffee shops or roastery. I think at the beginning it was more like, okay, we want to do something in coffee because we want to learn more in coffee.
And this is like 2011, 2012?
Yeah.
Okay.
And even earlier than that. And after, like, we worked together for like a year and did the association together and the events, we actually realized that Paris was like, people were like struggling for like good cup or know more about coffee. And
would you see from your event that people would have a cup of coffee and their eyes would light up, or they would be like, I've never had coffee because I did this way before?
They were like, I think both. Some of people were like, what the hell is that? Like, is that coffee? Like, it tastes like fruit and chocolate and cake, and what do you put in my coffee? And so that's a good step, because it's and some people were like, oh, that's very bad, like what's in it, like, and when you explain to them then that's about the aroma and something you can find in a coffee and we didn't add anything, they were like, oh my god, like, so I just discovered a new world of things. And and we were like so surprised, and people get the French population, which is good about that, is like they know about terroir, they know about like varieties of things, like we have that kind of culture about wine, about apples, about vegetables. So people very easily understand when we talk about like farmers, process, and they were very happy. So we were like, oh my god, there is some things to do. We should start early.
So then, where did the concept begin? Did you start with finding farmers, or how did you? I mean, the idea is great, but then where did you start the process of building the company?
selling coffee to people.
Yeah. how did you begin to change the industry and the practices of, you know, the last 300 plus years?
So David is got a strong part on that, because he worked in US in Washington DC, and he worked under, I mean, he was training from two big strong people about coffee. From a coffee shop he worked, it's called Murky Coffee at the beginning, and it was it's closed anymore now, but it was one of the best coffee shops ever. And he learned, I mean, many of the people he met there, and he learned how to make coffee great and testing coffee. I mean, most of our job is testing coffee, and that's, if you don't know how to test it, you can't buy it, you can't roast it, and you can't serve it. So he's very good at that. And from his relationship with the people over the world, we had like great relationship with importers, distributors, and roasters. So we were like, oh my God, let's talk to these people and ask them if it's a good idea if we start something, or if they're gonna help us to give advice on like who I need to call to import my coffee, or we need to call to have a good example of a profile for roasting coffee. And we had all of these people, and we started like that.
And you have a really great relationship with your farmers and suppliers. It's long term, it's not very short term. So how did you develop them? Who were some of the first ones to get on board with you? And if you can explain the nature of the relationship, because I think it's really important.
Yeah, it's so the main idea of working with these farmers for us is long term. We believe then we can do a real trade with these farmers, and we can grow and they can grow with us at the same time. To give you an example, we start the first year with a farmer. It's called Neptali Bautista. He's got a farm in Honduras in San Vicente, and when David went there and met him the first time, he was pretty behind the many farmers around his place, and because he used to do coffee, but not very like amazing coffee, and he knew the farmers around him used to do better quality and get better money with that. And when David met him, David saw in this guy some good, like, I don't know, a nice feeling, the full energy of like want to do better and want to increase the quality to increase his money, his revenue, because I mean that's what is important as well. And so we bought his coffee the first year, even if we knew that the coffee wasn't as good as it should be, because we believed then the coffee quality will grow. And the next year, his quality jumped so high that we were like, oh my God, that we bet on the right guy. And after 3 years, his coffee was better than everyone on the area. And I mean, from my point of view, and from many point of view of people around. But that's a great example of like, because it's been 4 years, 5 years now with Benny's coffee, because David used to buy it from Telescope as well. But and the quality went so high, then the price went so high as well. So we're buying his coffee much higher than we used to 4 years ago. But we're also selling it more expensive here. So that's the whole idea of Belleville, is that it's like we try to get the same farmers every year and working together to get like quality increase and price increase. Because I think that's something important that we need to think, is like if we want to keep good quality in coffee in general, we need to buy coffee to the farmers more and more and more expensive. Just because like people need to understand, we need more farmers. So we need people who get more involved in a good quality.
And how deep do you go into helping them build the infrastructure? Like now that you are so many years in, that you go and be like, okay, we'll get you this machine, or we'll get you this processor, or we'll get you better.
No, if we do that, it's not trade.
Right.
What I mean in trade is like, you do better coffee, I buy you more expensive. And I mean, these people, they don't need us. I mean, they need us for buying the coffee, give them advice for maybe from our part. But these people, I don't know how to grow a coffee tree. I don't know how to run a farm. And I think it's very kind of a past kind of weird colonialism. And I think then I don't want to, I mean, I want to help them as I can, but I don't want to go there and say, oh, I'm going to buy you that, buy you this. And, you know, it's like, I want to, for example, Neptali is still a good example on that, because the second year, and he got more money about his coffee because he cared more about his coffee and say more expensive. He had the money to build some bigger place. Then he plants a new crop of coffee in it. So in a few years, I'm thinking 2 or 3 years, we're going to have the first harvest of that coffee. So he's going to make more money on that. And I think it's the right way. I don't want to feel like, we like we're growing with them, but they know what they're doing. Like, it's to get the coffee, the qualities that we receive here, they don't need us. I mean, they're good at what they're doing.
When Belleville opened and started roasting, what was the time for people to start adopting to the coffee? Was it immediate? Like, they just tasted the quality, the difference in quality, or they're like, this doesn't taste like the other coffee that we're used to? Or how long did it take for people to start to catch on?
I think that's only because, I mean, it's because of the way we sell it, we bring the products. We believe that people, everyone can see the difference in good or bad. Like, I don't believe that people need like ages to train their palate, or like, I don't think so. I think if we do our job right, if we don't go on like too much acidity on the coffee or too much on that, and we try to find balance in the way of buying coffee and roasting the coffee, I think our customer, doesn't matter who they are, I think they can realize if they open to see and to try. I think that they can understand, and that's why we do, for example, with the cafe, is like we're not pretending to be like, I mean, we believe we serve one of the best coffee in France, but we don't push it, like we don't show it to people. We're just like, okay, that's a cup of coffee. If you like it, let's talk about it.
Let's talk about the cafe. How did it come into being, or what led to it, or what was the decision to do it? And the building itself, we could also talk about it as well, since it's so stunning.
Well, yeah, I can talk about it if you want. Belleville had been around for a couple of years, and we were the only roaster in Paris that did not have its own coffee shop yet. So there was a lot of expectation from our friends and from our clients. People were waiting for us to open a coffee shop. But our brand is very French. The name is French. Our brand imagery and everything relating to our universe is very French. We play a lot with the sock juice that we talked about earlier, and that's become kind of as part of our branding is the sock juice and the jus de chaussettes, and playing about how jus de chaussettes can be delicious. And we felt that there was a really great cafe culture in Paris, in France, you know, with the really old-timey cafes, with the brasserie and the specific furniture on the terrace, in rotin chairs. I'm not sure how those are pronounced, that's called in English. But instead of opening up a coffee shop, we wanted to really double down on the French side of on the French side of things. And we felt there's such a great cafe culture. It's a shame that you can't have that and delicious coffee at the same time. And so we decided to open up a really traditional French cafe, brasserie place that served specialty coffee, and that also had the same philosophy that we have with coffee on all the products that are served inside the place. So we have about 100 different suppliers for, 100 to 150 different suppliers just for this cafe here, which has a very simple menu. But every single item on the menu is sourced independently, and it makes all the difference. People really taste the difference, whether it's with coffee or any of the products that we serve.
Small details count a lot. I mean, it's as Jeff said about, like, if we get honey, we know where it came from. We know the farmer. If we get olive oil, we know where it came from, and sometimes we just pick it up ourselves in Italy, or like. And it's, as you say, like, it's about 200 supplier, but it's
just 1,000.
But it's
the Cloque Madame has a 900 alone.
I think it's 234, if I'm right, last month. But I think it's the point. I think in general in France, and I think France lost kind of that culture, but we used to have that kind of products 50 years ago. In every cafe, well, it doesn't matter where you came from, where you are in France, you should have that. And now in any places, you get the same menu, same drinks. You get like four suppliers, which is like suppliers for coffee and hot drinks, a supplier for drinks, for alcohol, for wine, and a supplier for the beer. You get three suppliers, kind of. And they all have the same Heineken or whatever. And like, and the problem is, like, I think people get bored of that, and that's never what we want. I mean, like, there's no point of like opening a place if you don't want to share like the good quality on everything, and for the beers, for the wine, and for everything.
So this is just not what you guys are doing. There's some projects that are opening coming this fall. What are you working on? We promise not to air this until it's public knowledge, but what are you working on? What's in the future?
So we just, Belleville started in a 50 square meter space in Belleville, which is we've completely outgrown it in terms of the roasting still happens there, but it used to also be our office. It used to be
a training center.
Yeah,
and you still do weekly trainings and cuppings for the community, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
which is amazing.
Yeah. Every Saturday.
Yeah, and Wednesdays also.
And Wednesday
for
the professional.
For the pros, yeah. And so we've got we're basically moving our production to a new space that we just got, and that's under construction as we're speaking, which is still in the neighborhood, but it's massive. It's 450 square meters, and it's going to be a lot of different things. It's going to be a boutique flagship space where you can go and taste coffees. Like you'll have a menu where you can really choose every single variety that we have and choose like which kind of extraction you want to taste it in. So it's more of an experience, discovery experience, as well as then the goal is for you to then buy any kind of coffee and equipment that you need for making coffee at home. So it's going to be really for shopping for coffee at home. Then in that same space will be a much bigger roasting space. Storage area, a whole classroom/cupping area where we'll do all our quality controls and also all our trainings. We'll finally have a really big office space, which we've been really lacking. And finally, we're also going to have a centralized kitchen, which is going to allow us to increase the menu options here at La Fontaine, while also supplying food to our latest acquisition, which is a coffee shop that we that's in Belleville, so we're staying true to it, staying true to our roots. We've just taken over a coffee shop that was called Cream, and that was started by some of Thomas' old employees, and it's going to reopen as a Belleville coffee shop in next month.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both for your time. Where can people find you, learn about your history, get your good sock juice, etc.?
it's all online at cafebelleville.com. It's cafe with an S. We do subscriptions, and we ship worldwide.
Incredible. Well, thank you so much. We're going
to
take another musical break, and then we'll be back with the second part of Snacky Tunes.
Tired heart now, darling, lift it up into the air, and I will notice you in this crowded room and whisper in your ears. Lift your tired head down, darling, lift it up into the air, and I will float to you in this crowded room. Let's get us out of here.
To me and the wall, I know love for your lily hand.
This episode is brought to you by Castor and Pollux, maker of America's number one organic pet food, Organix. You put a lot of care and thought into what you eat. After all, you're a food radio listener. That thoughtfulness goes hand in paw with how you feed your pets. Purposeful pet food doesn't happen by accident. Castor and Pollux scours the earth to carefully select the best organic and responsibly sourced ingredients. New Pristine from Castor and Pollux is the only complete line of pet food made with ingredients that are responsibly raised, caught, or grown. Feed your dog or cat the new standard, like grass-fed beef, wild-caught fish, and vegetables grown without synthetic fertilizers or chemical pesticides. Pristine from Castor and Pollux. Purposeful pet food. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org/pets.
Welcome back. We have Rhodes Rolland in the show.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. Ron, how's it going over there?
It's going.
Going?
Yeah.
Rhodes, you are from Colorado.
Yeah.
How was that as a childhood?
I was born and raised in Boulder. It's, you know, it's a beautiful place to grow up.
Stunning.
Yeah, I really loved it. By the time I was 17, I was really ready to get out. And that's when I moved to New York. But no, I loved it. I grew up actually at a bilingual school there. So I was kind of lucky to have maybe a little less of a typical Boulder experience there. It was like a 70% Mexican school. And I grew up immersed in Spanish there, and that was a really amazing place to kind of grow up and to that.
And what was the music scene like there? I've gone out to Boulder to do a couple indie rock shows in like the early 2000s, but it was not as receptive as one would have thought. So like, what was the musical landscape growing up?
You know, EDM is really big there.
Okay.
Like, it's embarrassing, but I do remember, like, blasting dubstep in the car when I was, like, 15, 16 years old with my friends. That scene is really big there. As far as, like, indie rock, I think, there is a scene. I always think of Fox on the Hill, the Fox Theater. Mm-hmm. There's some good spots. And I think there is a scene there in terms of, like, kind of a local live scene. But for me, I didn't really get immersed into it so much until I moved out of Boulder. So
you talk about like the Western landscapes and sound being a huge inspiration for you.
Mm-hmm.
What is it about it? How does that work its way into your music? Mm-hmm. Where can you find it in your songs?
Yeah, I on the EP I just released called Young Adult. Well, I didn't just release it. I guess it's almost been a year. I really tried to tap into kind of a spaghetti Western vibe with whistles and kind of slow, sad tremolo guitars. And I really envisioned the desert and mountainscape kind of a lot when I was writing. And I kind of looked at artists like Nancy Sinatra and Lee Hazelwood for inspiration when writing those songs. That EP is about growing up, and that was mostly in Boulder for me. And I wanted to tap into that sound and that feel of the West. So.
And you just mentioned, how old were you when you moved out to New York?
I was 17.
You moved to New York. So you were already on the East Coast, but looking West for inspiration. How did you balance being here, but keeping that kind of, you know, large, open plain, mountains in the distance, while not being influenced by Brooklyn, per se?
Right. Yeah, maybe I was looking outward. I never even really thought about that. We're so densely packed in here. You know, most of the work I do in music is still out West. I'm mostly in L.A. doing recording and working out there, and that was kind of a strange but fun dynamic for me. I was in college here, but flying back and forth to record and work. So that's, you know, that was another reason why I feel like it was kind of this almost nostalgic feeling for me, because when I was here, I really didn't want to be here. I was in school. I wasn't studying music.
What were you studying?
I was at NYU.
Okay.
Still
doesn't answer. What were you studying?
Oh, what was I studying?
Yeah.
Sorry, I said this where. I was studying cultural iconography.
Okay.
Which essentially is like looking at the branding of people. What makes somebody iconic in culture, and what are the visual aspects of that? And so it is very much related to the music
super
world.
Super helpful.
Yeah, and super interesting. And I love doing it. I'm kind of a nerd. I like diving into intellectual things. So I enjoyed being in school, but my mind was often somewhere else, and it was kind of out west. So.
Can we hear a song?
Yeah.
What are you going to play for us?
We're going to start with a song called Loving You. It's a song that's kind of become a staple of my set, but it's never been recorded, so.
Oh, well, here we
here
go.
It is.
Here it is. Here we go, live on Snacky Tunes.
All right.
You mentioned your young adult EP, which is now almost a year old.
Yeah.
It has so many great stories on it. Is there one in particular that you feel is kind of like emblematic or iconic?
Good word to use.
of the EP.
Definitely. There's a character named Wes that comes up in a bunch of the songs on that EP. And, you know, as I said, the story is about growing up. It's the EP itself is really a story of coming of age tales, kind of strung together. And Wes was my young first love.
Real or fictional?
Real, but fictional name.
Okay.
he kind of had a really tragic story. We were together when I was in high school. He was a bit older than I was. Left Boulder to go study in Kansas. He was not from the States, but he was a football player, American football player. And got a scholarship to play in Kansas. And we were not together anymore, but, you know, we kept in touch, and he was very unhappy there. He didn't fit in really as a foreign person where he was. It was a small town, and was just kind of down. It wasn't good. And he finally found out that he was eligible for a full ride scholarship to go to his dream school. Went out to go celebrate with his friends. They were in a car and got pulled over, and he had just a little bit of weed on him. Weed, what current at this time was not legal anywhere. It was, you know, had he been in Colorado, he probably would have gotten off with a fine at the time. But in Kansas, it was definitely not legal. He was arrested and put in jail for a quarter of a year. Simply because he wasn't a citizen. He had a super high bail. He was there that he couldn't get out. And once he'd served his sentence, he was deported. And his story was so tragic and just so upsetting, you know, just because a simple document, you know, he was treated completely different and really inhumanely. And I really wanted a platform to be able to tell that story. And so I tell his story on that EP, and I try to bring it up because there's so many people that go through that their stories aren't told. And I think in so many ways too, he was lucky to have been a white guy, in that situation. So that's that's pretty much the heavy story that I tell on that EP.
No more questions. Can you play another song
for us?
Yeah, I
know.
Just play
sorry
us another
for
song.
The downer.
No. Please play another song. What are you going to play for us?
This song is called Big Girls.
Ooh. this song. And if I knew what I should do, I'd run away from me and
you mentioned that you have worked in Mexico City. What brought you there? What have you done down there? Where's your favorite taco? Tell me all the secrets.
So, yeah, as I mentioned to you, I grew up studying at a bilingual school and was very immersed in Mexican-American culture, and have always been drawn to Latin culture in general. And I was going back and forth between New York and LA, and I had this project ready, young adult, and I really wanted to do something different. I wanted to release it in a different way. I didn't want to do a release show in New York or LA. Before that happened, I decided to go down to Mexico City and do a music video there, but I brought in a New York team with me, called Street Dreams Magazine. They're like a video collective based here. And there were like five or six of us, and none of us had ever been to Mexico City before. And you know, it's a massive place, and I didn't just want to be these American transplants down there that had no idea what they were doing. So I figured Street Dreams Magazine has like a big Instagram presence. So I thought I'd hit up some local Instagrammers in Mexico City to see if they would be interested in doing some type of collaboration with us. And we found a few people that were super down to help out. And they ended up completely taking on the project and like leading the way. And I thought they were such cool people. And it was so cool because they were like architects and photographers and fashion designers and people that they weren't really involved in music, but there's this kind of energy in Mexico City that like all these different types of artists are really collaborative and involved in each other's work, which I don't feel as much, at least in my circle here or in LA.
Yeah, we had Gabby from Contramar on earlier this year, and she talks about how it feels, how New York must have felt in the 70s when everyone was just into each other's stuff and just collaborating, and it just was, everyone's like, you're into that? I'm into this. Let's do something together. Let's mix it up.
Yeah, it's like so open, and it was so refreshing. And I was only there for 5 days shooting that video, which actually never ended up coming out. But it led to kind of a discovery of this artist scene down there, and I was like, I have to go back. So then fast forward to me releasing this project and wanting to do something different. So I decided that I would play a release show down there. And I, you know, reached out to those friends I made. I said, you know, is there anybody that might be able to help me put something together? I just want to play a show and, you know, see what happens. I had been there, I went down there knowing a handful of people. I was there for 2 weeks before I played the show. I think probably 150 people came to that show, and I knew almost every single person in the room.
It's amazing.
It was amazing. And it really doesn't have anything to do with me. I don't think I really, it's like an amazing community down there.
Well, where did you play the show?
It was at this bar called Shaman. Shaman. It's like a kind of Ecuadorian themed like bar with incense everywhere. It's super cool and cavernous, and it was awesome. So I ended up staying down there for a while, doing another music video, which did come out.
Perfect.
So it was all worth it in the end. And I just had an amazing time, and I'm so sad about what happened there.
I know. We have a lot of friends down there, and it's amazing to see how they're banding together. And if you're listening, please donate. They still need it. donate $10 every day or every week or $5 every other week, it goes a long way. Mm-hmm. You are in the process of making a new EP as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's the focus on that? You're grown up now.
Grown up at 22.
Grown up at 22. Is there a focus? Is there a protagonist? Or how is this different from young adult?
Yeah, this one is much less character-based. More, the central theme is more in the texture and feel of the music itself. I am still playing Western sounds, but I wanted to try to incorporate kind of a more diverse Western sound in incorporating what I think, you know, plays into what we hear as Americana music. So there are kind of some Latin Southwestern elements in it. There's also some like West African influences in there. I'm like super into Tanari Wen and can't stop listening to them. I don't know anybody who's not really into them right now. But I wanted to try to incorporate these things that I feel are part of Americana music. So textually, that's kind of the theme. And it's still in the rough mixing stage, but I'm really, really excited about it. And
perfect. We can't wait to hear it.
Yeah.
Well, we want to make sure we have time for one more song. Yeah. But where can people find you, get your first EP, check out your Instagram?
Sure. First EP is available everywhere, called Young Adult. So wherever you like to listen to music, it's there. And my Instagram is Lady Rhodes.
Perfect.
So I'm Rhodes Rollins.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Shout out to my brother. If you like this episode, please go into wherever you listen to podcasts and leave us a nice little note and give us a little 5-star review. We'd appreciate it. What's the name of the last song you're going to take us out with?
It's called Young and Thriving.
Perfect. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with an all new episode of Snacky Tunes. Here we go.
Thanks for having us.
free and farting. Fast like lightning, we both came under.
Talk about food. We talk about music with musical dudes. Finger on the pulse, snacky tunes.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.